It's time for Let's Talk with Brian Pettaway.
Good morning, happy Sunday, happy Super Bowl Sunday, and happy second Sunday of Black History Month. This is Let's Talk, and I am your host, Brian Pettaway, and today we're going to talk about Christianity and its role in Black history. Has Christianity helped Black people progress, or has it been a hindrance? Has it been a growth stunner? Well, today I'm going to have that uncomfortable but necessary conversation with the Reverend Dr. James E. Victor Jr. of the Mount Olive Baptist Church in Arlington, Virginia. He's going to sit down with me. I've also got the Petty here today on this Super Bowl Sunday. He's going to give us his Super Bowl predictions and a little pregame banter. And of course, you've got me giving you news, commentary, and our Sunday fun facts. So I hope you're feeling great, because I'm feeling great. I've got lots to talk about today. So let's get right to it. Well, in Baltimore, the long-awaited and anticipated verdict of Marilyn Mosby is in. Following a 12-day trial, the former Baltimore State's attorney was found guilty on Tuesday in U.S. District Court of one count of making a false statement on a loan application related to her purchase of a luxury vacation home in Florida. Sentencing for this case is scheduled for May 23rd, and Mosby could face some significant time. Maximum penalty up to 40 years in prison. Now, clearly, she's not going to get that. Most defendants in this case get significantly less time, and I expect that of Marilyn Mosby. She was found guilty in the mortgage fraud trial, but only on one count, and she was found guilty in the perjury trial, so she could be actually sentenced pretty hard. But most legal experts expect she'll see between 37 and 57 months, because a lot of that time will run concurrently, meaning at the same time. We're unfortunately going to have to wait until May to find out, but the trials are over. Also in Baltimore, the Baltimore Banner is reporting that one of the officers charged after the death of Freddie Gray has been promoted to oversee internal affairs for the Baltimore City Police Department. After a federal investigation into Freddie Gray's death, the Department of Justice opted not to bring charges against White and five other police officers that were charged at that time. Now, Captain Alicia White will move into her role on Sunday, and that role will include overseeing complaints filed by the public against Baltimore City police officers. Now, it's not lost on me, the irony is not lost on me, that as she gears up to take over this new role today as an overseer of complaints by the public against Baltimore City police officers, former Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby, the person that earned national attention and recognition by boldly accusing Alicia White and five other police officers of misconduct of Freddie Gray, causing his death, is now herself awaiting a prison sentence. Man, the table sadly really turned in this situation. And Lamar Jackson, quarterback of the Baltimore Ravens this week, was declared the most valuable player of 2023 in the NFL. This is the 27-year-old's second MVP trophy in his short five-year quarterbacking career in the NFL. And on Wednesday, Governor Wes Moore proclaimed Sunday, February 11th, 2024, as Lamar Jackson Day in the state of Maryland. So, in addition to being Super Bowl Sunday, today is also, henceforth and forevermore in the state of Maryland, Lamar Jackson Day. Congratulations to Lamar Jackson. And in the national news, a Texas woman was sentenced Friday to 3 years in prison after pleading guilty to charges of threatening a Florida judge who was overseeing the criminal case against former President Donald Trump and his handling of classified documents. Tiffany Gish, 50 years old of Houston, pleaded guilty in November to threatening U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon. The Justice Department said Gish left voicemails threatening to kill the judge while claiming to be a member of several military combat units. She was also sentenced to 3 years of supervised release. U.S. Attorney Alamdar Hamdani said in a statement that holding Tiffany Gish accountable for her threats to assassinate a federal judge sends a strong message that we have no tolerance for those who often hide behind a far-off keyboard or phone line, seeking to undermine our democratic institutions by threatening the safety of people who help those same institutions thrive. Now listen, that sounds great, but this is just the tip of the iceberg. Very soon, the Supreme Court of the United States is going to have to decide if individual states can remove Donald Trump from the ballot as a presidential nominee. And if they should make this decision solely based on the letter of the law of the Constitution, which is the 14th Amendment, Article 3, they'll have no choice but to rule that to be so, that individual states can remove Donald Trump from their state's presidential election ballot, deeming him ineligible based on his participation in or inciting of the January 6th insurrection. The fear is if that ruling is in favor of the states by the U.S. Supreme Court, once states start removing Donald Trump from their presidential ballots, all hell will break loose, and the threat to state government officials will no longer be threats. These Donald Trump fanatics will indeed start using violence as a way to try and get what they want, and that is Donald Trump to be the president of the United States. He is, in fact, a very, very dangerous man. All right, we'll be back with Sunday Fun Facts right after this.
Hey, Baltimore, make sure you don't miss the Christopher Williams Lovebirds pre-Valentine's Day catered dinner and concert. This would definitely be the hottest show of the Valentine's Day season, featuring a live full concert by Christopher Williams, straight from New Jack City. This very intimate show will take place at Martin's West Grand Ballroom on Sunday, February 11th at 5 p.m. with special guest Shay and music by DJ Jazz. Doors open at 3:30 p.m. and tickets are selling fast, so get yours now. For full menu and details, call 410-215-8893. This is a Sean E. Merriman promotion.
We are back, and it is time for Sunday Fun Facts. And by the way, if you just listened to that ad, you would understand that today is February 11th, and that concert is happening tonight at 5 o'clock at Martin's West. I don't know why it was chosen to be done on Super Bowl evening, but I hope those that are not going to watch the Super Bowl will attend this concert. It's going to be a good one. Christopher Williams has been around for a minute. He's gone through some things, but he is back and thriving, sounding great. So if you're not going to watch the Super Bowl, make sure you jump on down to Martin's West and attend this concert. All right, so on this show, it is time for Sunday Fun Facts. And I love this segment. I'm going to give you three. And again, jot them down, folks, because you never know what company you're going to be in where this useless information and random knowledge might come in handy. All right, our first Sunday Fun Fact for today is the average person will walk about 70,000 miles in their lifetime, which is the equivalent of walking around the Earth three times. And here's one that just annoys me because I hate traffic. But fun fact number two is the average person will spend 6 months of their life waiting for a red light to turn green. One more time. The average person will spend 6 months of their life sitting in their car waiting for a red light to turn green. You know, I regularly try very hard not to think about how much time I spend going from one place to another in my vehicle. I spend a lot of time on the road, right? But when I sit and I read something like this and I realize how much of my life is wasted just in my vehicle, it really pisses me off. Like, do I really have to go where I'm going? I gotta reevaluate how I'm doing things in my life. And fun fact number three. And this one for me is kind of cool. I don't know if you know anything about tennis, but if you do, you know that playing tennis at Wimbledon, there is no swearing allowed. Therefore, all of the judges that you see judging these matches have to learn swear words in different languages in order to enforce the rules. So these judges get to Wimbledon 3 weeks in advance, and they learn swear words in multiple languages, and they're paid top dollar to do it. Now, that is a job I wouldn't mind having. All right, so those are your three Sunday fun facts today. I hope you enjoyed them. I hope you jotted them down, committed them to memory, because again, you never know what party you're going to attend or what event you're going to attend or what kind of company you're going to be around where this random useful knowledge will come in handy. But it is now time to kind of get serious and talk about the topic of today's show, and that is, what role has Christianity played in Black history? Now, the reason I felt like I needed to have this conversation was because I've heard many times, that Christianity has been a hindrance in the progression of the Black race, meaning that we have taken the tools and the thinking and the psychology and philosophy of slavery wrapped in this package called Christianity by missionaries to steal land and valuable natural resources from Africans on that continent and to colonize it, which ultimately gave whites power. It was also used by slave masters, obviously, to keep us docile as slaves and believing that as long as we suffered in silence, were obedient, and worked hard for our earthly master, we would get our riches in heaven, the land of milk and honey. Now, I know you've heard that 1,000 times, and I've also heard the flip side argument of that, and that is without religion, without faith, without a belief in God, that slaves would not have made it. It was the only thing that let them know that there was a light at the end of the tunnel when going through such misery and pain, that one day that struggle would end and that they would be a free people. Now, I am not a theologian, I am not a religious scholar, nor am I clergy. So I needed to have someone sit down and talk to me who I felt was a straight shooter, who had the qualifications to give me the information and the knowledge that I needed to answer the questions that I have for him. And my team found such a person. He is the Reverend Dr. James E. Victor Jr. He is the pastor of the Mount Olive Baptist Church in Arlington, Virginia. He's been a pastor for almost 40 years and has a strong legacy of pastoring from his grandfather to his father to him. So I truly feel that we got the right person for me to have this important and candid conversation with. So sit back and enjoy. Okay, 1500 family, please help me welcome to Let's Talk Dr. James Victor Jr., pastor of the Mount Olive Baptist Church in Arlington, Virginia. Pastor Victor, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, and yourself?
I'm doing very well. I appreciate you. I know that you're kind of on vacation this week doing some fishing, so I really appreciate you being with me today and taking the time.
Oh, I'm glad to do it.
Now, this is Black History Month, of course, and I've tried to break the weeks down in categories as to kind of what I wanted to do for Black History Month. So I had entertainment, which was Miss Dionne Warwick last week. I'm going to have Kwasi Mfume on at some point this month. He's going to talk politics and activism. But also what's really been impactful to our people over time has been religion, Christianity in particular. So I wanted to discuss with someone what role it's played. And, you know, you have a master in divinity and a master's of theology and a doctor of ministry. So I think I have the right person to speak on those matters today. So you'll help me out, right?
I'll do the best I can. I've been in ministry for 37 years, and I'm third or fourth generation preacher, Baptist preacher, depending on which version of the family story you listen to.
Right.
So, you know, I've given my life to ministry and to the church.
Well, then you're the perfect person. The perfect person. So I appreciate it. I've attended Mount Olive Baptist Church. It was way back, like 25 years ago, I was stationed at Fort Myer. And so I've been there maybe two or three times, and it's a very well-attended church. Is it still?
Well, you know, COVID has wreaked havoc on everybody's numbers, and so we're still trying to recover and recoup and in the process of rebuilding. But we have a healthy membership.
Okay, well, that's great. I kind of wanted to take things back to the beginning, if you don't mind, as far as Christianity goes.
Sure.
And I've been doing a lot of reading and, you know, and researching anticipation of this show here. And I was reading a couple of things. One of them that stuck out to me was Desmond Tutu. And he mentioned that before missionaries came to Africa, you know, we had the land and they had the Bible. And in a short period of time, we had the Bible and they had the land. Is that how you feel about it? I mean, do you take the same stance? Do you think that religion has kind of stolen some things from Africans, so to speak?
Well, I wouldn't say stolen. I would say that Africa has birthed a great deal of Western thought. It just has never been given credit for it. So even the concept of monotheism is an African concept.
Okay.
You look at people like John S. Mbidi and Yosef Ben Yochanan, who tell us and taught us that it was in on the continent where this deep spirituality, though it may not have been Christian for the most part, basically gave forms to the world. And that was across the board, not just in religion, but mathematics and other arenas. And then the other thing that I think we have to be leery of is contextualizing the Black church and Black Christianity to a post-1619 experience.
Right. It's long before that. Correct.
It's long before that. And in fact, right. You know, many of the great thinking thinkers and theologians of the early church period were North Africans.
Right.
Augustine, Athanasius, Cyprian, Tertullian, folks like that who, you know, when the Pope wanted to define what holiness was, he calls Tertullian, I believe it is, to Rome to teach the whole church what it means to be holy. So embedded in the early Christian fathers and mothers and the early theology of the church are African concepts. What takes place is they get corrupted over time to then become oppressive rather than liberating to Black people, as the Christian message is corrupted by economic capitalists who want to exploit free Black labor.
And I'm so glad you mentioned that. I am, because when we talk about slavery, a lot of slave masters used religion in a psychologically depressing or oppressing way, right? To keep us docile, to keep us okay with what we didn't have and fear that we would revolt. So I guess the question that I have is as people got away from slavery, as we were freed people, a lot of people wonder why we carried on and still carry on that teaching.
I think for me, as a historian of religion, I think you have to reframe the whole argument.
Okay.
It was, yes, religion was used oppressively, but then the yearning of oppressed people always finds a way to find authentic spirituality and ways to express that. Okay. So while slaves attending white ecclesiastical settings were informed and inculcated with this notion of slaves obey your masters, there was another message that goes on in the Brush Harbor.
Okay.
And okay. So there's always this current, this driving current for freedom, for Black actualization, well, I should say for the actualization of Black life ambitions and hopes that were not necessarily given voice or given credibility in white religious settings. However, we constructed our own, and that's why you get the notion of the Black church evolving out of what's called the invisible institution.
Okay, all right.
And also, you got to remember that one of the earliest Black denominations that started in the early 1800s in Philadelphia with Absalom Jones and I'm getting old and forgetful. The AME Church.
Oh, Richard Allen. Started, was it Richard Allen?
Yes, Richard Allen, yes. So that predates slavery, and we need not think that Philadelphia didn't have slaves, just like New York had slaves.
Right.
And slavery was not only contextualized to the South. So, you know, I would reframe the argument because I'm not Marxist in that part of my analysis that says religion has been the opiate of the people.
Right. But here's the interesting thing about Richard Allen. The reason he formed or helped form the AME Church is because he was chastised, pulled from his knees, actually, literally, for praying in a white section, in a
yes.
section that Blacks could not pray in. So even in that sense, we had to create our own space to worship the same God that we were taught that loved everyone. And I just find that that's interesting.
Well, I think it is, again, but that's operating from the assumption that Africans were not exposed to Christianity until slave traders made their way into the continent.
Right.
And we don't know how much Christianity was extant on the continent. So we know that slaves were brought to America, not just America, but to the West, to the Western Hemisphere. Some were Muslims, some practiced traditional African religions, and I dare say that there were some practicing Christians on those slave ships as well.
There were, absolutely there were.
The mass transition from the invisible institution to the what we would call the Black church in its incipiency doesn't take place until you get the first Great Awakenings. And even then, in the first Great Awakenings, as they happened in Kentucky and Tennessee, were largely interracial settings.
Okay.
And there was a modicum of egalitarianism there. It was only later, as is usually the case, when this notion of freedom for Black people becomes something that is actually tenable, that you begin to see the repression of that institutionally, psychologically, spiritually, and in other areas.
You know, it's interesting that you did mention something, and I wanted to kind of break it down so that I could understand it. It sounds like, although we were taught by slave masters a particular type of Christianity that they were feeding us, we had to look through that and create our own version of that Christianity. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. That is what James Combs calls the black religious imagination.
Okay. All right.
The yearning for freedom negated the impracticalities and the evils of what was then dominated, what I would consider to be sterile white Protestant theology. And even Catholic theology, as we later learned just a few years ago from Georgetown.
Right.
So what takes place is you have this, what some have deemed America's original sin, racism, slavery. And it is given then theological legitimacy by the church. And that becomes dominant. But our ancestors, as Gardner Taylor used to say, we were told one thing, but we heard another. And I think that's just
perfect.
The movement of the spirit.
Right, that's a perfect explanation. That's a perfect explanation. I had not heard that, actually. So here's another question for you, actually. And I wanted to reference the Congo and King Leopold really quick. I read a letter that King Leopold wrote to his missionaries that he actually sent over to the Congo. And it mentioned how he wanted them to evangelize, but evangelized in the best interest of Belgium, right? Meaning that, and he was very specific about what he wanted them to teach. He wanted them to teach Africans to appreciate the poor, not yearn for wealth. He wanted them to appreciate working hard and not getting much from it. And he wanted to direct those teachings especially to the young, because they were the most likely to revolt if they weren't taught these things. Now, he killed 10 million people in a short period of time, all African, and stole all of their riches. So my question is, knowing that history and knowing that even here, we had to hear one thing and teach another, why didn't we call it something other than Christianity? Why didn't we splinter from that and call it something other than what they called it?
Do you remember the movie Amistad?
I do.
There's a poignant part in that play where Senke, and I forget his fellow African, who had seen a Bible, and of course he could not read English, but it was a Bible with pictures.
Right.
And he is able to deduce that Jesus was a suffering God.
Okay.
And yet there was something redemptive in that suffering. And I think that therein lies the affinity with Christianity, that at the heart of Christianity is a God who suffers and who suffers along with people. And for a suffering people, that's a resonating element that I think caused us to gravitate toward the Christian faith as opposed to other faiths. Now, mind you, let's be clear. While we like to think that all black folks are church-going people and Bible-toting people, that's not true. Never has that been the case. There's always been black secularists. There's always been black Muslims in some form or another. And so, but at the heart of black culture is this grounding spirituality that in this particular context of America has this overwhelming yearning to be free and to actualize black existence.
Right. All right. Well, I know that the Nation of Islam asserted that the Black Christian Church failed the Negro, and they were preaching separatism. I don't know, you know, how you feel about that, but I know that it garnered a lot of movement in the 70s and 80s and 90s. I don't know what that movement is like today, but I know that Malcolm had issues with Dr. King, but eventually I guess they came together for one cause. But you're right. Not all blacks were were Christians.
Well, let's be careful with our historical analysis, because, again, we have to allow people room to grow. So when it comes to Martin and Malcolm, what you see is a closing of the chasm between their thinking, so that by the time Malcolm is assassinated and Martin is assassinated, there's very little difference in their thinking and approach. Malcolm has become more not integrationist, but more, I would say, more cooperative, having adopted a more cooperative approach. And Martin is becoming more radically prophetic.
Okay. We don't hear those speeches very much, though, but you're right.
And I think that's why this platform becomes critical. And maybe you should get somebody a little more versed in this than myself to talk about these things, because, you know, this is the importance of Black history, and having those untold stories to actually be told.
Right. Where do you think the Black church is today? Are we losing young people from the church?
Well, I think across the board, if you look at church across the board, that's not just the Black church, that's every church in America, there's a decline. And Black Christianity is not immune from that. Are we losing people? I don't know that we're losing them, but I think what we are seeing is the Black church in transition. And these are not unprecedented transitions. I forget the lady's name that talked about every 500 years, the church, the pendulum in the church swings in the opposite direction. Well, we haven't been practicing Christianity in America that long, but we are seeing transitions. And I think the church is becoming something that will evolve into an entity that while it has historical antecedents, it's not going to look like, as the kids are fond of saying, your grandmama or your granddaddy's church.
Right. No, I agree with that. In fact, you know, I had Dr. Jamal Bryant on here a couple of weeks ago. And we were speaking about the activism that church has gotten into as far as trying to help the young and the underprivileged and what that role is. And I asked him specifically, what is the role that the church fills? Like, what is there a fear of getting involved in activism in the Black community or politics because of the fear of tax exemption being lost? Or do pastors feel a need to dive right into it without that fear? Where do you stand on it?
Again, I kind of recall at the framing of the question.
Okay.
because you know, I have a unique perspective on this stuff. I think that the Black church, to some degree, in one way or another, has always been an activist prophetic church.
Okay.
That is because, again, it's at its core is not just the preaching of the gospel and saving souls, but it is at its core is the actualization of Black being in an inimical environment that is trying to do its best to suppress, depress, and oppress Black being. So there is a level of activism in church. Even if the church is just sponsoring scholarships for its children in an environment that says Black children cannot learn, that's an activist approach. It may not be a march in the street. It may not be an assault on the Capitol politically, but it is an activism. And I don't think we can discredit that kind of prophetic witness just because it does not match up with the grandeur of the civil rights movement.
Okay. Now, you mentioned civil rights, and it's a good segue because I know that when Martin Luther King, in his early years, the Black church was not very supportive of him, and a lot of Black churches did not want him speaking at their churches. So we've come a long way from that time as far as fear goes, but I know that that was the case back then.
Well, somewhat of the case because, I mean, there was a difference between the National Baptist Convention and what became the Progressive National Baptist Convention over this very issue of the role of activism in the church. Now, you take Dr. Jace Jackson, who was the president of the National Baptist Convention. It was not so much that he was against civil rights. He just felt that God would eventually progressively make Black folks assume a greater and larger and freer role in society. And so it wasn't so much fear, but a theological undergirding that gave way to that kind of distinction. Now, don't get me wrong. There were some scared Negroes, and right. They're always scared Negroes. But by and large, I don't think that characterized the whole of the church. Then you also have to understand, again, in its context, you have what I call historically the Reign of Terror, which goes from like 1877 to roughly 1964, where violence and intimidation was a real threat.
Absolutely.
To Black existence.
Absolutely.
And so you get African-American clergy, men and women, where women are allowed to, that have protested and have been subversive to the system throughout. So again, I recall at such broad categorizations, which I don't think are the right frameworks for what we're talking about.
Okay. Where do you think the church is headed? And I ask that question is because, you know, with the advent of social media like Facebook and Instagram and YouTube, we can look at videos of right now pastors bashing each other, right? Churches doing crazy things, pastors doing crazy things, asking for astronomical amounts of money. How does one choose who to trust, right? We see literal pastors calling out other pastors. Don't go to that church. They're not preaching the word of God. And it's very interesting to me. It's very interesting to me. And I'm sure it's confusing for a lot.
Again, I would say that what we're seeing is really not a new phenomenon.
Okay.
In terms of your first line of the question, where's the church going? Again, I think we're in transition, and I don't really know that anybody has that answer. On my more optimistic days, I can see a very promising future for the church as the confluence of social media and youthful Black activism, along with young people's determination to redefine what church is for them and their generation, I can see a promising future. On my more pessimistic days, I am somewhat alarmed at what might be. But then I also recognize that we are all people embedded in time, and so what may be may not be for me to contemplate.
Okay. With women in particular growing in their roles of authority in all kinds of industries and companies, they're slow to grow in that role in the church, in the Black church in particular. Is that changing? Is that something that you feel should change?
I think it is changing. It's changing too slowly, but it is changing, and it is something that is long overdue in terms of the egalitarianism that the church should be demonstrating. And therein may lie the hope of the church itself with more female leadership.
I mean, I agree.
Well, I think what you talked about it earlier in terms of oppression and how religion has been used to oppress people. I think if we take Renita Weems, or maybe Jackie Grant, who was a Black womanist theologian who teaches or used to teach at ITC in Atlanta. She says that the Black church is really a female space in which men are allowed to lead.
Okay.
And if women throw off the internalization of some of their oppression and begin to demand differently, then I think you'll see an expedited process toward greater female leadership. Because as we know, by and large, churches generally comprise of 75-80% women.
Right, correct.
And so when women start demanding greater, I think you'll see greater.
What's interesting about that, though, is I've heard that most women that attend churches would prefer to see a man in the pulpit than a woman. So it's not necessarily the men that are holding them down.
What I'm talking about in terms of the internalization of oppression.
Okay.
that is something that has been inculcated, that's been taught and given some theological legitimacy. I can recount firsthand one episode in my own congregation where we were transitioning toward female deacons, women deacons, and one of the older ladies that we were interviewing and wanted to become a deacon. She had been a great servant of the church, just a wonderful spirit. She said, "I don't want to be a deacon because to be a deacon is to be a man, and don't want to be."
Okay, wow.
And that's some of what we are up against, but not altogether. There are, don't get me wrong, I'm not naive. There are power structures in place. I think we saw them a few weeks ago in Memphis, where female leadership is just not welcomed, nor is it embraced.
Right. Hmm. Do you think it is? Do you think it is a location issue? Do you think it's, you know, in the South, it's less apt to happen than it is in the North, or do you just think it's across the board as far as churches go?
I think it's pretty much across the board. I don't know that I would give it any regional specificity. I think it's just a problem that is entrenched. But it's not just the Black church. It's the whole country, okay. You know, and in every aspect. I mean, we question the vice president's competency to be the vice president. We just have difficulty with women in leadership, and the church is not immune from that kind of misogyny.
No, I guess it's not. It definitely is not. It really isn't. What do you think? We know what the church's role in Black history has been, as you've explained it to us so far. How do you think it's going to? How do you think it's going to help going forward? You know what I mean? I mean, there are a lot of things that are going on in the Black community now. I mean, I know there's prosperity preaching, which a lot of people are not happy with, and some people gravitate. How do you feel about prosperity preaching?
Well, I think the prosperity preaching movement has kind of waned somewhat. The Great Recession of 2008 put clamps on that kind of bad theology. And people began to really start thinking about what Jesus taught, what Jesus actually taught, which is assisting the poor, the needy, those who find themselves on the periphery of society. So I think the prosperity, I'm not saying that it's done, but I think its influence is waning because people see, are not necessarily fulfilled by it.
Okay. Do you think there'll ever come a time, or maybe it's happening now and I'm not aware, but do you think there'll ever come a time when there won't be like maybe a Black Christianity and a white Christianity? Do you think there'll ever be a time when we'll all, you know, come together and praise as one? Do we still have to have that line drawn?
I think there'll come a day. It's called heaven.
Okay. Okay.
I think as long as there are systems in place legally, socially, institutionally, you name it, that suppresses Black life, there's going to be relevance for the Black church. Because again, at the core of the Black church's existence is to actualize Black being.
Okay.
And as long as that needs affirmation, as long as Black life needs to be affirmed, as long as we have to remind people that Black lives matter, then there'll be a role for the Black church. What role that's going to play in the future, I don't know. I see some indicators if I look at the landscape. What folks are doing here in Florida in terms of beginning to develop a curriculum to teach Black history beyond February, where the schools have failed, that's a role for the Black church. Where the Black church can begin to form itself around doing church differently, to become incubators for businesses, again, that's a role for the black church to play. And there are churches that are doing that across the country. I think we just don't talk about those progressive ministries enough. We like to harp on all of the negatives and the naysayers about the church is not doing this and that. There's plenty of work, that good work that the black church is doing. I just don't think it gets publicity.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because when I had Jamal on a couple of weeks ago, or Pastor Brian on a couple of weeks ago, he was actually in Florida at the time, and he was telling me the exact thing you just said about churches taking on the role in Florida of teaching black history, because of what's going on with the curriculums down in the school system down there. And I asked him, I said, well, how come no one knows about this? Because I had never heard that before. And he says, well, I don't know, but it needs to get out. If it's not, I mean, I'm on Instagram and I'm on Facebook, and you know, I scroll through reels and Facebook videos. I have seen nothing about this anywhere until he mentioned it. Why is that something that is not put out there the way that it should be?
Well, I mean, Essence did a article on it on one of their online platforms probably 2 months or so ago.
But
again, I think this is a part of the love-hate relationship that people have with the black church. You know, we're prone, again, to talk about the negatives, the failures, the shortcomings. But a lot of good work is being done by a lot of congregations. I think we probably suffer in some respects from a Messiah complex.
Okay.
And we're looking for another Martin King to arise from the ranks to lead us to the promised land. And the real thing I think about movements that make movements impactful is that they become contextual and local. So when Martin has a platform at the Lincoln Memorial, and then local churches begin to implement those kind of strategies of pressing for jobs and voting rights, that's what that was done then. I think that's the real value of a movement.
Wow. Okay. I agree with you
100%. And the other thing that I think that takes place is where churches, to be quite honest, and I am biased as a pastor, I recognize that, I acknowledge that. I think sometimes we're so busy doing the work that we just don't bother to toot our own horns.
Yeah, and I agree with that 100%. I agree with that 100%. I mean, with all of the negative press that the church gets, you guys have to toot your own horns. I'm just being honest with you, because, you know, young people are not reading Essence. They're not. They are scrolling like I scroll. And, you know, the attention span is short. So, you have to get out of print and almost go and be and be on social media and give the little sound bites that are positive about the churches, because there are none. I'm just being honest. So that's what you're competing against.
Yeah. And that's just the reality of the landscape. But again, churches are also doing that, those sorts of social media platforms. Some of your leading preachers are doing those kinds of things. So it's not that we are sitting on the sidelines. I just don't think the church has the platforms that others are getting.
Okay.
Even in mainstream media, and even in lesser media.
Okay.
And maybe that's not a bad thing.
Really?
Maybe the works that we do should speak for themselves.
Hmm.
And again, that may not be some national leader that arises to lead the masses out of black poverty and illiteracy and crime to some great promised land. Maybe it's the local church doing what it's supposed to do.
Got you. So you see a bright future for the church and Christianity in particular in the black communities, it sounds like.
Well, I told you, on my more optimistic days, yes. On my more skeptical and pessimistic days, I am somewhat alarmed. I have to be honest and transparent. And it depends on what day you ask me. Today you caught me on a good day after fishing trip, and so I'm rested, and I'm somewhat optimistic.
Well, I'm going to end it on optimism. I'm all about optimism. I am. And I'm going to let you get back to your fishing. Listen, Pastor Victor, I appreciate you so much. I mean, I really do. Where is your church? Let's plug you. Where is your church located, the address?
We are at 1601 South 13th Road in Arlington, Virginia, about a mile from the Pentagon.
And do you guys have a website that people can attend?
We do. Okay. www.mtolivebc.org.
Okay. And you guys stream live on Sundays?
We stream live on Sundays at 9:30. We also stream our Bible study. We're on YouTube. And what's the other one? I forget. I got a media team to do this. So.
Okay. Is it YouTube?
On YouTube and Facebook. Yes.
There you go. YouTube, okay. And that's 9:30 Sunday mornings.
9:30 at Sunday morning. Yes.
Awesome. I appreciate your time so much. I mean, I really, really do. And hopefully I can have you back on if I have some questions.
Certainly, I'll be glad to follow up.
I thank you so much, sir, and we'll be talking soon.
Thank you for the opportunity. Have a great day.
You do the same. All right, well, I know that you hear the music. Again, that could only mean one thing on this show, and that means it is time for the Petty. Let's give the Petty a call and see what he's talking about on this Super Bowl Sunday.
Good morning, Brother B.
Good morning, Petty. How you doing on the Super Bowl Sunday?
Well, today is the day. I'm doing great. I'm doing fantastic. I'm feeling well. How are you doing this morning?
Hey, man, I'm just anticipating the winner being, you know, KC.
Is that so? That's interesting. That's a twist. Wow. I thought that you would have wanted the 49ers to avenge the loss of your Bumber Ravens.
Yeah, I do. I got to be honest. More than that, I want them to just kill the Swifties. Like, I'm just not with this whole Taylor Swift thing, and Mahomes is getting on my nerves, you know. So I was just playing with you. I do really want the 49ers to win.
Oh, okay. That's more like it. And speaking of the Ravens, congratulations to Lamar Jackson for winning his second MVP.
Yes, yes, yes.
And, you know, it's just so disappointing that he's not in the Super Bowl. I really was looking forward to the Ravens being in the Super Bowl. And, I mean, it's good he won the MVP. I'm happy to see that. But I just wish the Ravens would have been in the Super Bowl. I really do. I know I call them Bum Birds and all. And that's my hometown team. And, you know, I do watch it from time to time. And I root for them from time to time, depending on who they're playing. And it's just disappointing that they're not there.
Yeah, I agree. You know, but no. There's a progression to it. You know, I think that, I don't know, I don't think he's behind the curve. I mean, I think he's doing well for where he is in his career. And I think that, you know, he's still a young guy, 27. He'll get there for sure.
Oh, no question about that. I'm just, you know, a little upset that he's not getting all the accolades that he deserves. Yes, he did get the MVP, but they're still talking about him as if he's not one of the elite quarterbacks.
Right.
And he is.
They hate on him a lot. I don't know why. I don't know why they hate on that young man the way that they do, but they really do.
You know, I think it's the talent. They wanted to be a quarterback, a stand back in the pocket passer. And I think that's what doomed the Ravens 2 weeks ago when they played the Chiefs, that he tried to be the quarterback that everybody wanted him to be,
right,
instead of being the quarterback that he is.
Exactly.
Because, you know, and like I said, you know, when I talk about that game, I still think the Ravens just made a big mistake just going away from what they do best.
Oh, yeah, everybody
you gotta does. You got to do what got you there.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, they only scored 10 points. You know what? Let's talk about the Super Bowl.
Now, all right.
The Ravens may have laid down a blueprint for the 49ers on how to defend the Chiefs, because the Chiefs only scored 17 points.
Correct.
And if the 49ers can duplicate that same thing, I believe they'll come away as winners.
Right.
Now, what I have looked at, and you know, I've looked at a lot of football games, I've looked at a lot of teams, and one of the teams I looked at a lot of were the 49ers. And it's something that I notice about them in every game. They start off slow. You know, it's like their second half team. And I just don't think that that's the type of ball game they should be playing this evening. I mean, they got to come out firing on all cylinders. You know, when they're a team that jumps on you very early and often, they come out winners. Those two comebacks that they had against Green Bay and against Detroit, you know, it looked good because they haven't been able to do it over the years, but I'm looking at the talent which they did it against. They're not doing that against Kansas City.
No, they're not.
Kansas City has a pretty decent defense, you know, and they have a good offense that can keep the ball away from you. So it's a thing where they have to go down the field and score. And because I do not trust their field goal kicker, they need to be thinking about putting that ball in the end zone.
Yeah, and I got to be honest with you. When the Chiefs start off well, when they jump on you well, they do not let their leads diminish. They just don't. When they jump on you, they stay on you.
Well, I want to say I think it's going to be a high-scoring game, but I don't know. You know, the last time they played each other, it was played fairly well until the fourth quarter where the 49ers just had that major collapse. I think this is one of those times when Kyle Shanahan, because he has that reputation of blowing big games, that he cannot let up. He cannot be conservative. He's got to just put it all out there. This is one of those times where he got to go to his playbook, or his magic chart, or whatever it is you want to call it, and say, I'm pulling out everything. I don't care if they've never seen it before. I don't care if they've seen it before. If it works, it's going to get us, you know, to the finish line. That's what I have to do. This is one of those times.
How do you feel about Kyle Shanahan as a coach? Do you think he's better than his father was?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I can recall when Mike Shanahan was an offensive coordinator with the 49ers and with the Raiders before he became a head coach of the Denver Broncos.
Right.
And, you know, I was always hoping that he became the head coach of the 49ers, but it didn't happen. And you saw what he did with the 49ers and their offense. You saw what he did out in Denver when he had John Elway.
Right.
So I'm looking at Kyle Shanahan, and he is a good coach. You know, I think he's one of the best ones out there. He has some spectacular plays. He knows how to utilize the talent that he has.
I think that's his best asset.
Wasn't an elite quarterback, but he found a way to get Jimmy G to win.
Right.
Brock Purdy, he's young. He has a lot of growing to do, but he fits into Kyle Shanahan's scheme. And, you know, he's found a way to get the best out of Brock Purdy and make that offense go.
Yeah, I think the best thing that Kyle Shanahan does is pick talent and how to put talent together, you know. And he's built a really, really, really solid team.
And, you know, everyone knows this is the revenge match from the last Super Bowl. This time they'll be playing on the West Coast, which is more comfortable for the 49ers. Now, I mean, Kansas City is like in the Midwest, so it's not that much uncomfortable for the Chiefs. There was a little controversy over the practice fields. The Chiefs had the Raiders facility, and the 49ers had to practice at UNLV, and they were saying the field was a little soggy and, you know, a little messed up.
Right.
But you know what? When they get inside, it's all going to be an equal playing field. It's not going to be like that crap several years ago or last year when there was a big controversy about the Super Bowl and the field. So, you know, they're playing in a gorgeous stadium. I mean, that stadium out in Vegas is just fantastic.
Yeah, it is. It is a beautiful stadium.
The ticket prices are astronomically high. Nosebleed section, you're talking about $8,000.
Come on, man.
Between $4,000
and $8,000.
Are you serious? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're going to have to dip into your 401k, you know, get a second mortgage on your house, spend the kid's college tuition or something to get a ticket at the Super Bowl. And that thing is going to be sold out. So, it's definitely on my bucket list because I've been to a World Series game. I've been to an NBA Finals game. And, you know, on my bucket list is to make it to one of the Stanley Cup games and one into a Super Bowl.
I'm not interested in the Stanley Cup, but I definitely have to go to a Super Bowl game.
Well, because I'm a big hockey fan and Stanley Cups are the best 4 out of 7, I don't believe the tickets will be as high. You know, you have, like, when we went to the World Series, you know, we saw the Royals and the Pirates back in 79.
Right.
As you know, the World Series is the best of 7. When I went to the NBA Finals game back in 79, the same year, it was the best of 7 series. So, you know, I got a chance to go to where to finals where the tickets weren't as high. When you talk about, and the same thing with Stanley Cup, it's the best of seven. When you talk about the Super Bowl, it's one game.
And done. Yeah.
So they're trying to squeeze as much as they can out of that.
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
So I guess, you know, I'm going to dip into my 401k. I'm not going to put a second mortgage out on my house, but maybe dip into my 401k. And I'm really looking to go to a Super Bowl down in the Big Easy. I would love to see a Super Bowl in the Superdome. Go hang out on Bourbon Street a little bit,
right,
and have a good
right.
time. And just, you know, and I really don't even care who's playing. I just want to see a Super Bowl in the Superdome. That's on my bucket list.
And when you talk about squeezing as much juice out of one game as you can, you got to understand that, you know, you can have five games of NBA, and they're only getting 20,000 people a game to fit in that arena, typically. But you compare that to like an NFL stadium where you can fit in 70,000 or 80,000 people, you got your 5 games worth of attendance right there.
Well, Brother B, let me tell you something. I don't think those NBA final tickets or a World Series tickets are that inexpensive. They're getting paid. You know, the owners getting paid, the players getting paid, the people at the venue. It's a lot of money that's going to be spent at a World Series
right.
or NBA Finals. So it kind of equals out, maybe. But when I look at the ticket prices for the Super Bowl, I'm like, wow. And I'm going to look around, and when they pan the fans in the stands, it's going to be something really, really crazy to know that these people spent that much money for that one game, for that event.
Yeah.
And a side note to that, and this is really kind of funny, because I've been seeing it on TikTok and on Facebook and on Instagram. The Raiders and their fans will have to watch their rival, the Kansas City Chiefs,
play on their
field. And a team that they used to be right across the bay from, talking about the 49ers when they were in Oakland,
right.
play on their field.
Yeah, yeah.
That's something.
That is something.
So let's get on with this prediction. You know, I was happy for Andy Reid when he got his first Super Bowl. When he got the one last year, okay, you stuck it to your old team. That's why you got your second one. I don't want to see the Swifties. I don't want to see Andy Reid. I want him to just fade away. Yes, he's one of the best coaches out there, but now, Andy, they've given him his due. You have two. You don't have just one, you have two. You know, Patty Mahomes, and I call him Patty Mahomes, because everybody's just, I'm tired of talking, hearing about him too.
Right.
I look at some of these sports shows, and this guy, Nick Wright, he's got to be from Kansas City. He talks about the Chiefs so much. He talks about Patrick Mahomes so much. He's got him as the best quarterback to ever walk the earth.
Oh, my God.
And it's like, you know, the 49ers, go in there, do your thing. The 49ers are a 2.5-point favorite. That does not mean anything to me, because 2.5 points is nothing. That's less than a field goal.
Right, right.
So, you know, the 49ers on my team. Looking at it from taking my heart out of it and putting my head into it, I honestly believe that the Kansas City Chiefs are a better team than the 49ers.
Okay.
Yeah, I said it. And I will always try to keep it real when I think someone's better than the 49ers or better than the Ravens or better than the Chiefs or whatever. I'll put it out there. So I'm putting it out there. I think the 49ers are a better team. I think the Chiefs are a better team than the 49ers.
Okay. All right. But.
So for the prediction. I'm still going to take the 49ers.
I knew it.
Not because that's my team, but because you have certain players like Deebo Sanders, like George Kittle. They remember that loss against Kansas City.
Right.
And George Kittle said it. I'm going to be back here, and the outcome will not be the same. I will find a way to get back here. Well, he's there. And I think we're going to see a lot of George Kittle this season. I remember seeing Deebo crying when they lost. I think Debo's going to put it all out there. Good shoulder, bad shoulder, mediocre shoulder. He's going to put it out there. Trent Williams.
Yeah.
He's been wanting this for a long time.
A long time.
I think we're going to see a big game out of him, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there's certain, even Bosa, you know what I mean? I think there's certain players out there that remember that loss to the Chiefs and how it happened. And you have a guy that was on the Chiefs the last time. Well, you have a guy that's on the 49ers. As a matter of fact, you have two ex-Kansas City Chiefs that played in that Super Bowl against the 49ers. And they would love to stick it to their old team.
Who are they?
Talking about number 84, Chris Conley. He played with the Chiefs when they got that Super Bowl. And number 7, Tre'Davious Ward.
Okay.
He was with the Chiefs when they played the 49ers. So they would like to beat their old team. So I think, you know, this is a big one. This will answer a lot of questions about that 49er team, about their defense, about their offense, about Brock Purdy, about Christian McCaffrey, who I think is a stud of a running back. You know, man, I think that may be the missing ingredient that the 49ers need to beat the Chiefs. And
no, I think you're right about Kittle. Really, I think Kittle's going to be the X factor because they don't have anyone to match up against Kittle, actually.
Right. And I really think this is the game that Kyle Shanahan has to win.
What do you mean?
Because out of all the talk about him being a genius head coach, there will always be the stigma that he can't win the big one.
Right.
And they will always compare him to his father.
Yep.
And I think he wants to come out of that shadow. You know, yeah. It's not like he hasn't been there before. This will be his third go-round in the Super Bowl as an offensive coordinator and as a head coach. So this is, you know, this is time to get that monkey off your back, Kyle. And so get it done. On that note, I'm taking the 49ers by 8 because they're going to have to win by 8 points. Okay. They're going to have to win by 8. So I'm looking at a score possibly 31-23, 49ers.
That's an odd score, 31-23. Okay.
But there's your 8 points, Brother B. You can add, can't you?
Yeah, I can. I'm just saying it's an odd score.
I'm thinking they got to win by 8. 7 points, 4 points, anything where the Chiefs can come down and score a touchdown or get a field goal to take in the overtime is not going to get it. Now, I know 8 points is still a touchdown, but you got to get that 2-point conversion.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, give me the 49ers, 8 over the Chiefs.
Well, okay, I got you. Where are you going to watch it today?
That's a very good question. I'm going to go out and do a little bowling this afternoon to calm myself down because I know I'm going to be hyped later on this evening. So it's a choice between catching one of the local watering holes, mm-hmm, or just sitting at home. You know, so yeah, it's, I don't know. I don't see how I feel. I don't know if I'm going to be around. Because oddly enough, there are a lot of people pulling from Andy Reid in the Philadelphia area. So I don't think I feel like being around a bunch of Chief fans.
Okay.
So I might just be at home with my significant other, and we are going to sit there and watch the game.
Well, before you go, man, there's one thing that I missed last week that I wanted to talk to you about, but I forgot to mention it to you, and you forgot to mention it too. And it's probably because it's a fictional sports character, but I'm talking about Apollo Creed, Carl Weathers, passing away. He was.
Oh, man, you know what? I forgot to mention it too because, oh, my goodness, when I was sitting at home and it came across my TV screen, I was watching one of the sports shows, and it came across the TV screen, and I was just shocked. I was just really, really shocked. I mean, I remember him being a former Raider.
Right.
But, you know, he was a bigger name, yes, as Apollo Creed.
Right.
Yes, as Action Jackson. And the Happy Gilmore movie with Adam Sandler. No, I mean, and in Star Wars. You know, right. And it's just like when I
saw Predator. Predator just, as well.
And Predator, you're absolutely right. We're on like Predator. And I'm telling you, man,
it stung.
Oh, Weathers, man. Yeah, it stung.
Big time.
Yeah, I mean, it really kind of hurt because I was really upset that he was not in the Creed movies.
Right.
You know,
right.
I know that in the Rocky movie, you know, he kind of passed away when he was killed by Drago. But just to have some type of flashback where he would be in the movie. You know?
Right.
And I was kind of surprised that that didn't happen. But, man.
I remember.
That was huge.
I still remember the first Rocky movie. I think.
Oh, yeah.
I think. Wait a minute. I think your mother took us to see that. And
yes, she did.
Right? And
up in the Randallstown Theater.
There you go.
Up in Randallstown.
Right.
I remember it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember Mommy took us to see that, and I remember thinking, there's no, he's got to be a professional boxer. You know what I'm saying? Like, you couldn't tell me that he wasn't a professional boxer, that he wasn't a heavyweight champion of the world. I was like, how did they get him to play this role? He was so convincing in that role.
And it's funny because Sylvester Stallone gave a tribute to him, and he said that he brought so much to that movie, and it's just that he was the ultimate athlete because he transformed into that role so easily that it was hard for anyone to believe that he didn't have any type of boxing background.
You couldn't tell me he didn't have any boxing background. He was amazing.
He said the way they choreographed it and everything, said he was just right on his mark with everything.
Wow.
And he said he just got into that character and he tore it up. And it's really a shame that when you look back on the Apollo Creed character and Carl Weathers playing that role, it's just amazing that he was never even nominated for a supporting actor.
That's exactly what I said. I said that last week. He should have gotten an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. He was amazing in that role. Amazing.
He was. And as a matter of fact, he was in four of the Rocky movies. And in my opinion, I think his best performance was in Rocky III.
When he was training?
When he was training Rocky.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's what his best performance. Yeah. Yes, he tore it up in one and in two, but you saw more of the character
and the acting
was
ability.
No longer boxing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And training his rival to beat a fighter that he shouldn't have been able to beat. Right. And I think that's when he gave his best performance as Apollo Creed. That's just my opinion.
Yeah. I don't look, no argument from me. I just wanted to mention it because we didn't talk about it last week. And I was like, damn, I forgot to mention it. But yeah, it definitely, that stung me. So rest in peace to Carl Weathers because he was an amazing actor.
Yes, he was. And on that note, Brother B, you enjoy the rest of your day. With those topics, man. Oh, man. Boy, keep on doing what you're doing. Enjoy the day. Enjoy the Super Bowl this evening. And you always like, I say tonight. Enjoy that Super Bowl. Let's hope we don't have to see no more of the Swifties until next season.
I'm with you on that.
Go Niners.
All right, brother.
On that note, I'm out of here. Peace.
Peace, brother, man. Peace. Well, there you go. That was the Petty, and I agree with him 100%. I do not want to see any more of the Swifties. Call me a hater, whatever you want. I'm just tired of seeing Taylor Swift when she's not out on the field. Like, I get it. The NFL is making tons of money off of her name at this point, jerseys and all kinds of stuff, selling off the shelves. But I cannot stomach watching her for another season up in that booth. All right. It is about that time. The hour goes by so fast on this show. I want to thank the Reverend Dr. James E. Victor Jr. for joining me today and talking about how religion has played such an important role in our black history. I obviously want to thank the Petty for being with me again today and talking about the Super Bowl and his picks. Remember, he picked the 49ers by 8. I don't know. It's just an odd score for me, but 31-23. But, you know, it is what it is. We'll see. I got the 49ers winning as well. At least I hope that they win. I really don't have a dog in this fight. I just don't want KC to win. So I guess I do have one in the fight. I'm hoping that the 49ers win. I want to thank you as well, obviously, for joining me today. And remember, if you've missed any portion of this show or any show at all, you can always go to voiceswired.com, which is my website. Check out all the shows. All you have to do is click on the Let's Talk tab, and all of my shows are right there from newest to oldest. This show will be up on Tuesday, as they are every Tuesday, and you can listen to it in its entirety, and it's all for free, so please go there. I hope that you do. Also, I'd love to hear your feedback. Like I say every Sunday, I got a lot of feedback on the Dionne Warwick show. I thank you so much. I have not been able to answer all of them yet, but I will get back to you. But yeah, she's an icon. She's a legend. And I'm so thankful that she was able to join me, and I'm thanking you for listening. Apparently, a lot of people listened, and that's always helpful. And I know that to be true because I got a lot of feedback. Feedback is very important. Let me know what you think. Give me some topics to cover. Help me out. Tell me what I'm lacking in. Tell me what I'm strong in. I love all of that, please. So hit me up on Instagram, @onwithbrianpettaway. I'm right there for you, and I will get back to you, I promise you. But listen, it is Super Bowl Sunday. Kick back, chill, do nothing today, like I always say. The best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. So watch the Super Bowl tonight and then wake up tomorrow morning invigorated after this 49ers win. I can't believe I'm saying that, but I do want the 49ers to win this game. And please, please, please make sure that you are moving in a way that is inspiring to others. And also keep your eyes and ears open and be open to being inspired by someone else. That's how we got to do it. That's how we're going to make it. And I will join you here next week, same time, 10 a.m. on 1500 Radio, Baltimore's authentic multimedia experience. Have a great Super Bowl evening, people, and an even better week. Peace.